Keris Matthews, and this is the Tell Me the Truth About Life podcast. Poems that matter and why. It's launched for National Poetry Day's 25th anniversary. I love to champion poetry because when someone shares a poem with you, it gives you an insight both into the person who shared it with you and the world we live in. In this podcast series, author Michael Mopurgo, Instagram poet Nikita Gill, actor Jay DeNuca, teacher Kate Clancy, and comedian Henry Normal each take us on a tour of their touchstone poems. In conversation here with Susanna Herbert of the Forward Arts Foundation. All these contributors feature in the anthology I've curated. It's called Tell Me the Truth About Life, a National Poetry Day anthology, 100 Poems That Matter. It's published by Michael O'Mara Books to celebrate the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day. I hope you enjoy it.
One of the many who submitted poems to this anthology is the teacher and writer Kate Clancy, who teaches English at a very, very mixed comprehensive school in the east of Oxford. Now, Kate has submitted, or rather sent in and nominated, a number of poems which touch on truth for her. And I'm going to hand you over to Kate so that she can tell us why she's chosen them.
So usually when I'm teaching poems, I read the kids' poem and then ask them to write me a poem back. And only certain poems will kind of really work for this, I've noticed. And they have to have a strong frame, a strong sound to them. But they also have to be truthful. They have to have that exposed edge of almost indefinable, but you know when you hear it. It's not about being realistic in the sense of having lots of naturalistic details. It's about saying something fundamental that's true, that they know about. And this poem by Simon Armitage, which is simply called Poem, is one of my most valuable poems in that way.
Poem. Frank O'Hara was open on the desk, but I went straight for the directory. Nick was out, Joey was engaged, Jim was just making coffee, and why didn't I come over? I had Astrid Gilberto singing Bim Bom on my Sony Walkman, and the sun was drying the damp slates on the rooftops. I walked in without ringing, and he still wasn't dressed or shaved when we topped up the coffee with his old man's scotch. It was only 10:30, but what the hell, and took the newspapers into the porch. Talking heads were on the radio. I was just about to mention the football when he said, "Look, will you help me clear her wardrobe out?" I said, "Sure, Jim, anything."
It starts off very relaxed and speech-like with some detail that's now what the children would call vintage, in that it's got a directory. It has Astrid Gilberto singing Bim Bom on that antique thing, a Sony Walkman. None of this bothers the students ever. They recognise the stance, they recognise the mood. This is just about someone not doing anything, is what one of my students said. And then when he arrives at his friend's house and they're having the coffee, they acknowledge the thing that they're not talking about, which is that there's been a death and they have to clear the wardrobe out. And I've never had any student not understand that that's what the poem was about. You don't have to push and press for that truth. The truth reveals itself. The death that we all don't want to acknowledge just reveals itself in the poem.
Kate, I'm really interested in why you choose particular poems, but I'm going to dial back a little bit because I want to know about your story in relation to poetry and, well, not even the classroom, poetry and truth, full stop. Is there something that you find when you're talking about poetry or watching people engage with poetry, is there something that's absolutely different about that? Is it quite different from the way in which they talk about a film or engage with a novel?
I think it's just a bit more condensed. I mean, a poem does all the things that a novel does. It has a character and a voice and a plot. It's just it has it all in a very focused, short space of time, which is one of the reasons I love to teach it, because it's very concentrated. You can just get it out and get it back. But it's also very, very completely sensuous. I think I like my colours and my sounds and everything all mixed up. And that's how I kind of perceive the world. And a poem is a very perfect mirror of that for me, is kind of the most intense form of communication. When I'm talking to a poet, once we get past poetry gossip, which is, we always do, poets are dreadful people really in many ways, but then you get to that very intense thing of actually talking poems to each other, then that's a very pure, deep form of communication. And to give a student a poem and have the student give you a poem back is also a kind of pure, deep form of communication, sort of exchange of truths.
So talk me through the way in which you first discovered that poems can do things that people don't expect them to be able to do.
Well, for me, I mean, I didn't quite dare to write poems for a long time. I was, you know, teaching them and reading them. I sort of stumbled on contemporary poetry. I didn't really realise that existed. And I didn't really realise that women could write poems. I know that sounds a bit daft, but it was the 1990s. And then I discovered Carol Ann Duffy, and it was just a very pure moment of enablement. I read those poems. They spoke to me on a very profound level. And it was also said, you could do this. This is your world. You can recognise this and you can speak. It was an it enabled me to speak. And I started writing.
Tell me about the poems that first enabled you to start writing. Which ones?
Carol Ann Duffy, Sharon Olds, Salima Hill, Grace Nichols. Those women writers who were writing in that as themselves, as women, about their lives, that just kind of allowed me to realise, I think I'd waited much too long to be the object of a poem, and I realised I had to be the subject of the poem and get out there and say something.
By waiting too long to be the object of a poem, do you mean that a lot of women throughout history, I suppose, were hanging around waiting for somebody to say, will you be my muse? Or, we as women have kind of expected to find ourselves in poems as the thing that's looked at and addressed.
Yes, the thing that's described in the poem, wanting to be. I mean, those are all the poems I was taught were the ones about where women were described. And I can't really, they can now catch me. I read the poems about beautiful women in bits and they no longer do anything for me. I no longer feel I'm failing by not being that person. I just feel that is such a boring, worn-out trope. You've really got to stop.
So what do we do about the fact that when you look back in history and the kind of great list of poems in the Oxford Book of English Verse or whatever, it is overwhelmingly poems written by chaps looking at women or wishing women would pay them a bit more attention or regretting the fact that a woman's been so inconsiderate as to have gone and died or things like that?
I think we can remember that these are the ones that are written down. I mean, English poetry is only one strand, and the ones that we've written down is only one strand of that. Most poems across most of time in the history of the world have been written by peoples and languages. I mean, Homer used many lines for many people, and some of those people were women. I mean, when I teach students from cultures which haven't been industrialised, like from Afghanistan or Arabic cultures, women there exchange poetry and verse and jokes. Especially if they haven't learned to read, they especially do that. And that's how the little lines of descriptions, the metaphors of language get formed. And in cultures which haven't industrialised their poetry and put it in books and made it into something that belongs to just a particular class, that's how poetry is made. People make it together. And I find that quite encouraging to remember, that the inheritance that we have, and it's not that I don't value it, because I do, it's beautiful. I love so many male poets, it's not true to say I don't, but I do remember that there are other poets as well, and there are other women poets whose voices will never be written down working right now. And the thing to remember is that we are allowed to join in, because that permission to join in, it's like we only value the solo singers. For most of the time, we've had a whole chorus of voices. And if we only value those special male voices, then we won't feel empowered to join in. We need to feel empowered to join in.
How does that work in practice? Do you find that a poem will be picked up by a whole number of people and they will take bits of it and make it their own? What do you mean by a chorus making a poem?
Well, people will pick up. If I give that Simon Armitage poem to a group, 20 kids will write back in that rhythm and they'll give me their days back, and maybe 10 of them will be quite derivative. 10 of them will be really interesting. And they'll reveal, 8 of them will reveal some really interesting truth or another that they've chosen to reveal through that form. And that will happen over and over and over again. And I do that in my classrooms over and over again. It's fascinating. And it's just that they're empowered by the shape to answer. I just think it's a very primary thing that we've almost forgotten. Maybe it's too embarrassing to think that poems can be made by everybody. Maybe we don't want that to happen. But I experience this as happening. I experience it as something that people will do if you just say you are allowed to.
That's interesting, because I discovered that more people in this country, I think it's something like 3% of the population, have admitted to writing a poem in the past year.
Good.
And yet, very, very few of those really get published, and very, very few people walk into a room and say, I am a poet. If the truth is that being a poet, is it true to say that being a poet is something you do as well as everything else? Is it just another way of saying, you know, I'm human?
Well, it's a spectrum. I think most people sing, and people long to sing, and probably, you know, if you look at the X Factor, what's ghastly is that everyone's trying to sing on their own. If they were singing in a chorus, it would be a wonderful noise, as any time you do hear people singing together, it is wonderful. And I think everyone is entitled to write a poem. There are very few gifted individuals, and it's quite a strong gift. When people have got that gift, it's very noticeable, because it's a sort of synthesis of image and sound and thought that just a few rarely gifted individuals have it, and that's very notable, and they can call themselves poets. That's fine. But the rest of us are allowed to have a go. We're allowed to write a poem in our lives.
And the origin of this book and this podcast has really been in asking people to come up with poems that mean something to them. And what I found very interesting was that almost everybody, even people who say, I don't like poetry, almost everybody can name a poem that they associate with something important in their lives, whether it's something their mum sang to them when they were a child, or a poem they came across at a time of grief or celebration. So is the problem really that we talk about poetry in the abstract as opposed to poems?
Possibly. Also poetry with a capital P inside a book. If people were thinking of the words in their lives, the images in their lives, the ones that mean something to them, the pattern of words, then I think most people like that. Everyone likes that.
You spoke about coming across people who do have something which sets them apart, which suggests that they don't just write poems or commit poetry. They are, in fact, poets. I know that there's a poem that's been nominated not by you, but by somebody else, by a student of yours.
Yeah.
And I thought you could read that.
Yep. This is my student, Mukahang Limbu. And believe it or not, he wrote this poem when he was, I think he was only 13, and he was sitting in a group of very gifted kids. They volunteered, they came at lunchtime. So Mukahang came from Nepal when he was five, and he really is, he's very gifted. He's very gifted in many ways. He's gifted for drama, he's gifted in music, he's intellectually gifted, he's got a place at Oxford to read English and German, but he's definitely, certainly a gifted poet. But even there, I think, you know, you can say, here is somebody with a mark on him, he will be a poet. Mukahang might be many things, and he might choose to write poems for some of his life and do something else. But it's just a good thing to have enabled him to have written these poems now. And I certainly, this is a beautiful poem. So this poem is about how he first came from Nepal. And it was written in bits, and we constructed it into a kind of a story later on. And I can't remember all the different origin poems of it, but there are several. And I always encourage kids to write about their, you know, the sensory experiences. Actually, I think the first couple of stanzas, he did actually go off and write this completely on his own and then bring it back into school. I remember that. But it doesn't come directly from anything I did with him. I especially love the last stanza, in this place where I did not know the things I did not know, embrace me in ways I didn't know, because that encapsulates the openness of his personality, that he regrets in some ways what's happened to him, or he's been through pain, but he's open to things he doesn't know. He's open to loving them, open to changing them. When I first came from Nepal, by Mukahang Limbu. As I clutched my suitcase, thick, hot sweat built in the slits of my palms, which shook, holding its cool metal brace, we walked into day winds, thick as dried out paint on unwashed canvas. The sky was painted daffodil yellow. The ground was a dirty grey. There was a metal bird, an array of fearful, forgotten paint. missing the feeling of home. I smell the iron rust of the municipal gardens. The sour tang of home still sits on the tip of my tongue, like the zest of sweet citrus fizzing. I did not know of grey gravel roads or the bright buzzing of scarlet cars. I did not know of lonely red-bricked houses, gazing strangers standing next to next, military officers in endless rows. I did not know of silence in the streets or the secret whispers on the buses or the sly gestures of restaurants. In this place where I did not know, the things I did not know embrace me in ways I didn't know.
I remember when I first heard of Mukahang, as you say, you came as a, I think he was a, he's from Nepal, he's a refugee of some sort, but his mother does not speak English.
His mother doesn't speak English or write English.
No. Yeah. So the story here is of someone working in a language which doesn't actually exist for him at home, but saying things which are very close to home. Do you think the fact that you have so many children in your class who have more than one language changes the way in which they approach the truth through poetry?
Yeah, they've got very interesting truths to bring. I think being able to write in a language that your mother doesn't understand is actually a great gift to many writers, because then you can say the things that you really want to say without the risk of her ever understanding them, which is, I think, quite a brilliant freedom for speaking truths. But then they bring the truths to their other languages just in the words that they're using. And you can hear the tunes and poetry habits of their verse coming through and what they're writing. Because, you know, the language that you speak shapes what you can think. And to change languages when you're 6 or 7 radically opens the mind, I think, very often.
Do you want to give me an example? Because I know there's some children who wrote poems which you help them translate.
So Mohammed Asaf came from Syria via Lebanon when he was only very little. He was only 11 when he hit this country. And he was a very small boy, beautiful looking little boy. And he just sat down. He wanted to write a poem. We had an Arabic poem put in, and he started to write in Arabic. And I didn't know what he'd written. I knew he'd written quite a lot of stuff. I sent it off. And then it was returned to me by the academic who'd very kindly translated it. This devastating little poem went, "My beloved mother, when I go to my house, the pain of missing her arrives before me." And that dreadfully piercing little poem made me cry. And any time I want to make someone cry, really, I just show them that page of the book, and it always has that effect.
There are a lot of people who've got preconceived notions about poetry. And in fact, it's extraordinary that poetry still survives sometimes, given how much it's been ignored by people. And it's not really part of the big conversation. People will talk about music, they'll talk about movies, they'll talk about novels and plays and, you know, incompressible modern art. But quite often, if you say something like, "Have you read any good poems recently?" they'll look a bit frightened and start muttering something about studying Keats at school. Do you see any possibilities of that changing?
I think that's changing enormously. It's changing right in front of our eyes. First of all, many of my students come from very alive poetry cultures. I've never met an Arabic speaker who would say that about poetry. They always at least say that it's important, and they certainly read a lot of it. Or an Afghan, actually, who didn't think that poetry was important. But I think in this country it's becoming much more prevalent. Young people read it a lot. It's a surprising number of white working class young people read it a lot. They have it on their phones, they bring it to me on their phones, they look at things like, I was introduced to button poetry by a student, a disadvantaged student. They've shown videos, and there's Instagram poems. And I think that is very much alive. It's much more, it's actually a good time for poems. It's never been a good time for poets to get paid, and this is not a good time for poets to get paid, but it is a good time for poets to get read.
So is it something that, you know, can change a school? Obviously, you've seen it in the schools where you have worked, and I use the word schools because you've written an amazing book about, you know, 30 years of teaching in lots and lots of different schools. But is this, as is sometimes said, a Kate Clancy thing that only you can do, where you go, poets spring up in your footsteps? Or is it something that possibly other teachers or even parents could also do?
I think lots of people can and could teach poetry. In school curriculum, as we have it right now, is a tragedy. It's almost illegal to teach kids to write poems. There's no curricular provision for it. There's no exam that you can take. There's no reward for it. Teachers positively feel that they're depriving their kids of essential skills if they stop to write a poem. I was able to do it because I was doing it on my own time, my own money, as an add-on. And that's not really a satisfactory solution for the country, but it doesn't mean that what I did, which is go in and read poems with kids and ask them to write them back, is a difficult thing to do. Well, it takes a lot of focus and faith, but it's certainly reproducible. But teachers need to believe that it's okay. They need to believe that they're allowed, and they need to be allowed, which are all things that we could change.
Is there a particular poem that means a huge amount to you? A poem, you talked about Carol Ann Duffy, are there particular poems that attach themselves to you at a very early age and said, yeah, this is something that I would like to have?
Hundreds. I read all poetry all the time from teenage years, not children's poems. I was never... I had the Child's Garden of Verses, but I didn't think I read many. I had lots of narrative when I was much younger. But as soon as I was a teenager, I used to have a small copy of Palgrave's Golden Treasury with a fifth book by John Press, and I did literally read it all the time. That was my favourite book. I think Yeats was one of the first poets I ever liked. I remember reading that under the desk in chemistry.
Which Yeats?
The Swans.
Wild swans
at cool. The trees are in their autumn beauty, the woodland paths are dry. Under the October twilight, the water mirrors a still sky.
You started to write poetry, as you said, when you were in your 30s.
Late 20s.
And you enjoyed a great deal of success. You won a Forward Prize for your best first collection, and you were rather a kind of big deal in the world of poetry, and people look to you as I think a ray of light and hope and change. And then of late, you've done a great deal of other things. You've written a number of scripts for radio, you've written novels, you've written non-fiction. You appear in many different guises, but you no longer define yourself first and foremost as a poet. Why is that?
Well, I haven't written a poem for 15 years.
So do you have to write a poem to be a poet?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's a hollow poem, isn't it? I am a poet. How do you know you are a poet? I'm a poet because I've written poems. That means you were a poet. And I think that's right. You were a poet until you're writing again. I just lost my confidence. I no longer have the confidence to write poems. But I do try to encourage other people.
I've got a sense that once a poet, always a poet, but I've got an even bigger sense, which is that there are quite a lot of poets who don't write anything at all. I think there's a man called George Oppen, who didn't write anything for a good 20 years. But
I think it's better than writing things that aren't very good, which, you know, I think the middle years are difficult, you know, when you've got children. That's breaking confidence to write about them. I think writing about a baby, which I did, is one thing, because a baby's a baby. But writing about children, they're people. So that's difficult. People do write quite boring poems in the middle age.
Well, what I've noticed,
they find themselves writing about traffic and things. It's not good.
Yeah, I did get a bit overwhelmed when I realised that there was a Korean poet who I think had written a poem for every single day of his life. And he was, you know, living a long life. And I remember feeling, I really need an editor to get me through this. And the great relief on finding women poets like Marianne Moore or Elizabeth Bishop, whose collected works really can be held quite easily in your pocket.
Or Larkin, you know, Larkin wrote barely enough for a collection, really.
So the whole idea that, you know, in order to be a poet, you've got to write a lot of poems isn't quite right. Just to write one or two really good poems should surely be enough to earn you the status in the world of poet.
Yeah, probably. But, I mean, I should say with kids, I just say, I'm teacher. And I think kind of lounging in and saying, I'm a writer or not, you run the danger of saying, I own it. And they already feel that. So you need to I think my need to own things or own art or own poetry is much less important to me than helping other people feel that they can own it. So I think maybe I've just got in the habit of stepping back a bit. I don't go on about what I've done. I don't quote my works at them or anything like that.
Oh, I wonder if they've found out that you're a poet.
Every so often they go, Miss, you've got a Wikipedia page.
And then you change the subject.
Yeah. That truly impresses them, the Wikipedia page. Yeah.
I hope you tell them they're going to get Wikipedia pages too. Yeah. Is there anything that you would give as advice to people on and around, you know, this year, the 25th year of National Poetry Day? Is there a top tip?
Read lots of contemporary poetry and then allow yourself to answer. I think it probably is contemporary poetry because that's now. There's something about the voices of now speaking to you. And then instead of saying, oh, well, I couldn't do that, I shouldn't do that, they're poets and I'm not, just write back, let yourself.
And does it matter if it's not perfect?
Of course it doesn't. Nothing's perfect.
What does matter? What does matter in a poem? Is there such a thing as a poem which really, you know, shouldn't exist?
Well, I think some level of truth and authenticity matters. Authenticity is always a good look. So to try and say the thing that you mean, using the words that you mean, and an authentic poem, a truthful poem, will help you to do that. And if you manage to write a truthful poem, even if it's short and has inelegancies in it, you will know and you'll feel the truth of it, and other people will feel the truth of it. And that's much, much better than writing something that's very accomplished but isn't truthful. One of the things about truth, though, is it might be discomforting. It might be not something that you knew that you meant when you set out. People think that you're writing a poem and you know what the meaning of it is, and that's not true at all. That the journey of writing it takes you to the poem, and it can take you to the truth of it as well.
Yeah, because a lot of people think, I must write about my heartbreak. And if you've ever judged a competition where children send in, or teenagers send in, a lot of poems, one can open those envelopes with a slight sinking feeling, as if they've all been written by almost one person and there isn't really much originality. It's a feeling like, I better use these words and this language. And yet those writers would say, that's authentic, that's what I feel.
Yeah, but then we sense the inauthenticity. Because when you're using other people, when you're writing in clichés, when you're writing derivatively, then you're not being authentic. You're using other people's experiences. You can write about heartbreak, and if you write about it authentically, it still will be interesting. You can write about anything at all, as long as you do it authentically.
Yeah, I'm still nagging away at the idea of the authenticity, though, because it strikes me that if you just emote onto a page and say, I feel absolutely miserable and the sky is grey and the sun isn't shining and the birds aren't singing, please come back. That's
inauthentic, though. That's using clichés.
It is using clichés. But how do you get people away from that when they look at you with you know, big eyes and say, but this is exactly what I feel? How do you then say, look, open a little door somewhere and think of another way?
You show them a poem. I really never say to people, that's rubbish or that's not really good. I always say, I like that bit. And now let's look at this poem and see what else we can do.
So which poems do you take them to? Obviously the Simon Armitage, and, you know, might help at this stage if you gave us a few other examples of the kinds of writers who spring to mind.
I have particular prescriptions for particular people. But in the classroom, I make a huge amount of use of Simon Armitage, Carol Ann Duffy, Raymond Antrobus, Grace Nichols, Rebecca Perry, Fatima Askar, Edip Cansever, mostly very contemporary poets. And there is something about, you know, Raymond Antrobus, Rebecca Perry, very, very now. Melissa Lee Horton has an absolutely magical effect on working class girls, for example. Kate Tempest. And if you can show them that it is so powerful, you can't overestimate how underwritten about these people are. So for a mixed heritage boy to see Raymond Antrobus writing a deeply authentic, but also very complex, also very excellent poem is an incredibly empowering experience, and that will help them to write for themselves.
You talk about teenage girls who might have bad stuff happening at home and find themselves in a kind of life which isn't really reflected much in the books they're being taught at schools. What kind of poetry works on a, let's say, a girl from a broken home?
Melissa Leigh Horton, very, very powerful testament. But also Simon Armitage. I mean, that's to go back to where I began. I can sit with a group of girls from broken homes and read that Simon Armitage poem about Frank O'Hara and the desk and the cupboard, and a whole bunch of completely excellent poems about things that happened to them in their lives came back in the same rhythm. Because that poem is authentic, even though it was written with a Sonny Mortman in it, by a man 25 years previously, girls from broken homes recognise that authentic thing, which is about surface happiness and then underlying tragedy breaking through in people's lives. And they recognise that the truth and the beautiful way that poem's put together, and they borrowed it to create their own poems.
Finally, Kate, I'm going to ask you about a line which always comes to my mind whenever I think about poetry, which is a line that occurs in the book. It's from Emily Dickinson, and it's almost like an instruction. It goes, "Tell all the truth, but tell it slant." And I suppose it's the indirection that is celebrated in that line that makes me interested. It suggests that there isn't just one way of telling a truth. There isn't just one thing to say.
You can't tell a truth directly. You'll end up telling a lie. You have to just say the different things that were there. You have to say about the slates on the rooftops and what you had in your coffee, or you won't be able to say the thing about the wardrobe. You have to get the surfaces and the details and in the indirections of the mind, and then in the gap you'll find the truth.
In the gap you'll find the truth.
Hmm.
And in the gap the reader gets to meet the writer and gets to meet a version of themselves.
Yeah, in the gap they get to put themselves, and then they have a contact with the writer, I suppose. Yeah, contact with the poem.
Yeah, contact with another way of seeing, perhaps.
Hmm.
Another way of perceiving. Well, thank you very much, Kate. You've spent your lifetime kind of coming closer to poetry and helping other people to come closer to poetry. So I think everybody who has read one of your books or found your words changing them owes you an enormous amount. And not just you, it's the people who you have connected to poetry who will be writing and changing the world in ways that we don't really know yet. So thank you.
Hang for Poet Laureate. Yeah.
Thanks, Kate.
Tell Me the Truth About Life is published to coincide with the 25th anniversary of National Poetry Day on October the 3rd, 2019. It's published in association with National Poetry Day and Michael O'Mara.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and share it. Or better still, find a poem that speaks truth to you and let me, Keris Matthews, know what it is on Twitter using hashtag Tell Me the Truth About Life.